This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a roundtable discussion of the top stories in the news. Now, from CBS News headquarters in New York, here is senior correspondent Bill Lynch.
This past week, evidence emerged pointing to a deliberate nosedive in the Egypt Air crash. 10 years after the Berlin Wall came down, questions about U.S. military readiness, anti-American violence curtails presidential visit to Greece, and attacks in Pakistan may be linked to Osama bin Laden. To discuss these and other stories, we're joined this week by correspondents Bob Orr, Lou Miliano, Kimberly Dozier, Bob Fuss, David Dow, Bob McNamara, and Mark Noller. Also checking in will be reporters Tula Vlahu and Owen Bennett-Jones, along with CBS MarketWatch correspondent Stacy Tisdale, our military consultant, retired Air Force Major General Perry Smith, and technology journalist Larry Magid. Well, the flight data recorder was recovered this past week from the watery crash site of Egypt Air Flight 990, and it tells a disturbing story that nothing was apparently wrong mechanically with the Boeing 767 before it plummeted from some 33,000 feet, killing all 217 people aboard. Bob Orr covers aviation for us, joins us from Washington now. Bob, what's the story the data recorder told?
Well, Bill, it's a chilling tale. I mean, the experts have looked at the flight data recorder, and what they see in the 40 seconds of data is an airplane that appears to be in perfectly good flying order in a nose-down, very steep, very high-speed dive. But it's quite clear from all of the information gleaned from the flight data recorder that someone was at the controls. The chance now that this was an airplane that just ran amok because of a mechanical or systems failure seems to be nil. And it doesn't seem like there was any obvious known problem on the plane that the pilots were responding to. So all of this raises questions. What was going on? It seems that the pilots at least initially began to dive. But for what reason? Was it because they were forced to by someone in the cockpit? Did they do it on their own? Or is it some kind of exotic, bizarre mechanical failure or series of failures that we've never heard of till now that doesn't show up on the flight data recorder that caused the pilots to precipitate a dive? But if that was the case, why didn't they make a distress call?
And there was
investigators are very puzzled.
There was no other traffic in the area. They wouldn't have been trying to avoid a collision.
No, that's right, but you know, the fact that it is a high traffic corridor, they wouldn't necessarily know that there are no other planes around. And if they did start an emergency descent, they sure would want to get on the microphone to say, we've got a problem, we're coming down, because the last thing they would want to do is go into a nosedive to avoid one problem, only to encounter another plane. So there again, this raises some real questions about what was going on up front.
And we know that the automatic pilot was deliberately switched off, correct?
Correct. We know from the flight data recorder the automatic pilot was disconnected. But here's the interesting thing. The automatic pilot can disconnect one of two ways. Either the pilots can turn it off when they take control of the plane, or there can be a sudden input to the plane, either by the pilots or by a mechanical system, that is so extreme that it forces the pilot to be disconnected. In this case, the tape tells us that the autopilot was disconnected, and for 8 seconds thereafter, the plane flew perfectly straight and wings level, and that's when the dive began. Another bit of at least circumstantial evidence, and strong circumstantial evidence, that it was the pilots themselves that took the plane into the dive.
Now, there is precedent for a suicidal commercial plane crash.
It's unthinkable, but a couple of years ago, there was a plane in Indonesia that crashed from high altitude. It was a Silk Air 737, and what investigators have learned since that crash happened is that someone disconnected both the flight data recorder and cockpit voice recorders and put the plane into a high-speed spiral that killed everyone on board. The official finding there is that it was a deliberate act of suicide by the pilot with multiple counts of murder. I have to be careful and say that no one at this point has any evidence that that happened in Egypt Air, but at the same time, it's the kind of chilling scenario that cannot be ruled out.
Well, all of this puts new emphasis and added importance on recovering the cockpit voice recorder. Correspondent Lou Miliano joins us from the Newport Naval Station, where that search continues.
Yeah, it's pretty frustrating too for the recovery crews, because they keep getting ups and downs with the weather. One day you've got 4.5 foot swells out there, and then the next day you've got 8 to 12 foot swells. And one of the problems they've had is the USS Grapple can't work in water any higher than about seas any higher than 8.5 feet, because as you try to get it over the side, you don't want the thing banging up against the side of the ship, and you can't have too much tossing and turning of the ship because it can't maintain an anchor. And so when the seas are higher than 8.5 feet, that can't operate. So that strips them of that asset. They do have the Magnum, which is a privately contracted submersible. It's much more powerful. It's got a 10,000-foot tether. It has a great deal of thrust and power on the bottom, and its ship remains in position with a 360-degree thruster, so it doesn't need an anchor. But they've had technical problems with it. They put it in the water twice, and twice now they've had to pull it back up and have repairs done on it. And then the USS Grapple keeps coming back into port to resupply and then going back out again.
Lou, how long will the Pinger keep operating?
30 days. 30 days. And so they're hoping, you know, that they can get that thing up, because it is critical information now, what was going on in that cockpit.
Lou Miliata reporting from the Newport Naval Station, where that search continues. The United States Embassy in Pakistan was the apparent target at week's end of 7 rockets that were fired in Islamabad. Several people were injured, but there were no Americans among them. Reporter Owen Bennett-Jones reporting from Pakistan. What do we know about this attack and who might be behind it?
Well, the rockets were placed in vehicles parked at strategic points throughout the city. I had a look at one of them, and it was a very homemade job. It was just a couple of metal barrels welded into the back of a car, and the rockets were fired from those cars. The back blast of that detonation completely destroyed the vehicles and engulfed them in flames, but the rockets all missed their targets, some by literally more than a mile. And they landed happily in harmless places in the city, and the injuries, as you said, were very slight.
Now, this comes coincidentally just as UN sanctions are due to go into effect against the Taliban in Afghanistan for having not turned over Osama bin Laden, the terrorist. Any suspicion that there's a connection?
Yes, there is suspicion that there's a connection, but the Taliban have strongly condemned these bomb attacks and said they had absolutely nothing to do with them, and that might well be the case. We just don't know. Certainly the Pakistani authorities say they've got no reason to believe that the Taliban were involved, but they're not ruling it out, and they are investigating the matter. But there are many other militant groups based in Pakistan itself who would consider the United States and also the United Nations, and a United Nations building was targeted in this attack. Both of those would be targets for many groups in Pakistan, and we just don't know who did this.
Thanks, Owen Bennett-Jones, reporting from Islamabad. Of course, President Clinton plans to visit Pakistan early next year. He also has plans upcoming to visit Greece, but those have had to be radically changed. We'll go over that when we come back.
You're listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Anti-American protests and some violence have prompted the White House to postpone and to scale back President Clinton's upcoming visit to Greece. White House correspondent Mark Noller, it seems the real concern here wasn't the president's own safety, but that of his traveling party.
Well, that's exactly right. In recent days, there have been a series of protests and demonstrations, some of them violent in Greece, and the White House understandably was worried about this. In discussions with the Greek government, the White House arranged for a recommendation to be made by the Greek government that the president put off his trip to Greece at the start of his trip to Europe, which was supposed to get underway this weekend, and instead visit Greece at the end of this coming week after his visit to Turkey. And that suits the White House just fine.
Most of this seems tied to opposition to U.S. actions over Kosovo, even though Greece is a NATO member.
Well, that's exactly right. The president notes that there are communists and anarchists in Greece that took great exception to the U.S.-led NATO airstrikes on Serbia. There are many in Greece with religious connections to the people of Serbia, and they resented and were against those NATO airstrikes. And they have been quite vocal and demonstrative in their protests of the NATO action and of the anticipated presidential visit. And as a result, there's a November 17th group which marks the crackdown by the military in Greece on student protesters back in 1973. And each November 17th, which is this Tuesday, they have big demonstrations. The president would have been in Greece just about that time, but now because of the delay and the rescheduling of the visit, he'll be there a few days later.
Mark, let's call in Tula Vlahou, who's in Athens. Tula, will this have any long-term effect on U.S.-Greek relations, do you think?
Well, some people here are predicting that it will, that the American side may hold this and say that Greece could not be trusted to set up a state visit. Now, others, more logical people, are saying that this will blow over. And because Greece, it is the only stable country in the region, that the U.S. really can't do much about it, except perhaps fume a little bit.
And in terms of the government itself, are they going to suffer?
The government is already suffering. In fact, the prevailing opinion is that this particular government failed to balance the right of the protesters to demonstrate and to ensure the most important political visit since President Bush was here in 1991. So right now the government is trying to recoup, is trying to assure the residents that having President Clinton in Greece is important and a significant opportunity for Greece. I should just say that the government today announced that the president's visit will take place on April 19th to the 20th, that all measures necessary will be taken to ensure that nothing goes wrong, and that while they're saying everyone has a right to demonstrate, they're going to make sure that that right to demonstrate will not conflict with the country's interests.
Mark Noller, you mentioned Turkey. Where else would the president be going on this trip?
Well, the president's trip begins in Turkey. He'll spend 5 days there. Then he goes to Greece for a couple of days, then to Italy for a conference. And then he becomes the first American president to visit Bulgaria, where he'll be paying tribute to 10 years of a transformation to democracy. And just a couple of days ago, the White House announced that the president will add one last stop. He will visit, spend a few hours in Kosovo at the very end of his trip, visiting with U.S. troops there in a pre-Thanksgiving visit, and also taking a look and assessing the basic human needs of the ethnic Albanians who until a few months ago were refugees from the Serbs.
Mark, to switch gears a bit, the president this past week was pretty feisty in defending his trade policies ahead of international trade talks in Seattle later this month. He did so at the Harley-Davidson factory in Pennsylvania.
Well, he saw that as a way to demonstrate and to illustrate his approach to trade, which is that the more the United States can open markets abroad, even if it means opening U.S. markets to foreign goods, that it's good for Americans. He spoke to workers at the Harley-Davidson motorcycle factory in York, Pennsylvania, and he told them that since 25% of the product that they produce is sold overseas, the way that they can expand their sales is to expand overseas trade. And so this was a way for the president to make the case that expanding overseas trade is good, and he's looking forward early next month to the World Trade Organization talks in Seattle, where he hopes to get a new round of negotiations going designed to expand free trade between nations.
Well, we're more than a month into the new fiscal year, Mark, and the week ahead could produce a budget deal in Washington. Bob Fuss, our congressional correspondent, the Republicans in Congress and White House staffers are using some creative accounting to save billions.
Well, they certainly are. What they're doing is using the creative accounting to make it appear that they're not tapping into the Social Security Trust Fund, and that's something that both sides are actively doing. I think we're close to an agreement. One of the key stumbling blocks was education. President Clinton was quite adamant that the extra money in the education budget, over $1 billion, be used for hiring teachers. The Republicans wanted to be able to use it for anything the local board wanted. The president mostly got what he wanted, except that up to a quarter of the money could be used for training teachers as opposed to hiring them. But there are still some issues to be resolved, UN funding, third world debt relief, some environmental issues that are very tough. Congress really wanted to make a Veterans Day deadline. They missed it. And hopefully by the end of this coming week, they'll have a deal.
I'm struck by a couple of the creative accounting techniques. One is by postponing by one day a military payroll, and that would save $2 billion.
That's right, and that's part of a pattern of things they're doing, which are, they're basically games. I mean, they're gimmicks. They're just, you know, in order, as I say, to make it look like they're not spending the surplus. Are basically, it's called forward funding. It's pushing things into the next year. They're taking, you know, budgets. The budget runs from October to October, so they're basically saying, okay, well, here's money for this, but don't spend it until October 1st, which in essence pushes it into the next fiscal year. And in some cases, like the military pay, it doesn't have you know, very much of an impact. In other places, though, like, for example, in health research, it could be a problem. It could mean that grants for doing different types of research can't be started until later in the fiscal year, so that you sort of take advantage of this trick. Another trick they're using is declaring a lot of things emergencies, including the census. And if you declare it an emergency, you don't have to count it in the budget.
And they're seizing broadcast licenses from some bankrupt companies and reselling them.
Well, they're looking at a number of ways to raise additional revenues, and that's one of the things that's still being negotiated. You know, President Clinton promised them that all this extra money he wanted for health, for education, for a number of different areas would be paid for in some way. And that is still a subject of negotiation of how exactly they're going to be paid for. And some of them will be probably budget tricks, and some of them could very well be real reductions in other programs.
So bottom line, politically, who comes out as winners and losers?
You know, they both try really hard to come out as winners and think it's important. My guess is that for the most part, the public thinks that this whole process is a bit silly and all of this last-minute fighting, and that it always happens late. And I don't think either side really has gained tremendously this year in the budget battle.
So the best idea may have come from George Bush this week of doing this every 2 years instead of annually. Anyway, we'll look at the military aspect of the budget when we come back. Learned this past week that the Army recently rated 2 of its 10 divisions at the lowest C4 level, meaning they're unprepared to fight as complete units because they're split between their home bases and peacekeeping duty in the Balkans. Retired Air Force Major General Perry Smith, our military consultant, do you think this is a national security problem or a case of Pentagon budget politics?
No, I think it's a national security problem because in addition to the units being split, they also are undermanned. They're short on logistics support and short on training. So you not only have these two divisions that are in bad shape, other divisions are in borderline bad situations. So there is a lot of corrective action undertaken in the program, but it's going to take 3 or 4 years to get it fixed.
Now, this means that the Pentagon's worst-case scenario for structuring its forces, being able to fight two Gulf Wars at the same time, couldn't be done or couldn't be done as well as we would like.
Well, that's correct. Now, remember that the last 3 or 4 wars we've had in the last 10 years have been largely been taken care of using air power from the various services. But if you had a 2 ground-type wars, the Army just couldn't do them near simultaneous with two divisions out of the game.
Now, the scenarios in the current geopolitical structure would seem to suggest the Korean Peninsula is certainly one of those possible conflicts. Where might the other be?
Well, the other one, of course, is the classic one, and that is Iraq, and Saddam moves against Kuwait, and all of a sudden we have to throw a lot of forces into that situation. Other places that could raise up would be the Iranian situation, and there's always a possibility that some would jump up somewhere where you're not anticipating it. But Iraq and North Korea are the two most likely major regional contingencies.
Let's go back to White House correspondent Mark Noller. Of course, this report set off fireworks there at the White House, didn't it?
It did, and the White House is worried that the president not be seen as not taking action to revive the military. During the president's watch, military spending decreased over the last 7 years, year after year after year. In his Veterans Day speech at Arlington National Cemetery on Thursday, the president made a point of saying that he was committed to America's men and women in uniform remaining the best trained, the best equipped, the best prepared in the world. And he said he pointed out that his military budget that he put through this year will increase military spending for the first time in a decade and also provide the biggest pay increase for American troops in a generation.
Well, Perry Smith, one of the problems, it seems, is this huge recruiting gap that the Army and the Air Force seem to have.
Yes, it's really a problem, and the Navy also has it. And in addition, it's a retention problem. For instance, the Air Force this year will miss its first year, first term enlistment, reenlistment, and second term reenlistment goals, as well as missing its recruiting goals. So the combination of poor recruitment and poor retention has put the Air Force in the lowest position they've been probably since World War II, and the other services, with the exception of the Marine Corps, are suffering from similar kinds of problems.
Well, Bob Fuss, in a booming economy, of course, military paychecks don't seem particularly attractive. Is Congress giving serious thought to significant raises in military pay?
I don't think there'll be another raise. I mean, the raise that was put in this year's budget, and that's one of the bills that was signed, there wasn't disagreement on, is pretty substantial. I mean, it was more than the raise given to other federal employees, more than the raise Congress gave to itself. it was a very substantial increase in pay. And so I don't think that there's going to be another one anytime immediately. Obviously, this is an issue that people in Congress are concerned about. There's been complaints for quite a while that the military isn't spending enough on readiness. Depending on one's perspective, you know, there are some who argue that that's because they're spending too much on new weapons and technology and things that may not be as important as training and readiness and the kinds of things that that help retention, and others who think that the military budget needs to go up even more than it has. And as Mark mentioned, the military budget did go up substantially in this year.
Mark, there was some suspicion that Republican members up on the Hill were in cahoots with some generals at the Pentagon on this.
Well, you know, one of the things that the administration often says is that Congress is spending money in the defense appropriations bill that the president signed, although he had objections to it, for things that the Pentagon is not even asking for. One of the things the White House likes to point to is a naval vessel that'll be built back in Trent Lott's home state, the Senate Majority Leader's home state in Pascagoula, Mississippi. The White House says this is a ship that the Pentagon says it doesn't need, and it's $500 million that could be spent elsewhere.
Well, one of the places U.S. forces are deployed, of course, is the former Yugoslavia. And in Belgrade, President Milosevic remains under opposition pressure to call early elections. Correspondent Kimberly Dozier joins us from Belgrade. Kimberly, any movement toward that?
Actually, it looks like it's moving steadily in the opposite direction. I've just met with opposition members this week who admit elections now, which they had hoped to have in November, probably won't be until the spring. And it looks like, as hard as this winter is going to be here, that Slobodan Milosevic is turning this to his advantage. He's putting out patriotic sort of slogans and posters around town saying, you know, turn off your lights, save energy. This is all because of NATO. And people are, if not believing it, what they're seeing is that Milosevic, while weaker, is still the guy with most of the goods. And as people tell me on the street here, he's the one who's going to get them through this winter.
Now, the opposition has control of the Belgrade city government and a few other cities in Yugoslavia, in Serbia. But the parliament moved this week to cut that power.
They did, and what the opposition says is they're basically powerless to stop it. Milosevic has control of the much of the financial system. They say some of his cronies have control of the black market. Now, that's not something that I can really get a handle on or prove. They also contend that he has local government is in his pocket. After a certain point, they can get the top positions, but say they want to clean the streets. Well, they've got to power the street cleaners and pay large amounts of money for gasoline to some of Milosevic's cronies who are bringing the gasoline into the country. They say that is a sort of the way that they are kept under control and the way they're not able to bring and provide for the people here.
So an indicted war criminal consolidates his power.
Absolutely. And I've met a number of depressed people in this city, both students who demonstrated in the marches 2 years ago. They said, you know, there were 500,000 to 1 million of us out on the streets. What good did it do? And I spoke to opposition members who admit that they're watching it slip away. They say they went to Washington this week and asked Washington to lift the sanctions so that they could get a hold of some of the resources that would make people's lives here easier. They say until that happens, Milosevic is using the sanctions to bolster the power because everything's funneling through him so he can parcel it out.
Kimberly Dozier. Next up, besieged Microsoft goes retail. Despite a big setback in its antitrust battle with the government, Microsoft shareholders gave a standing ovation to Bill Gates this past week at their annual meeting in Bellevue, Washington. And Gates has formed a new partnership to sell products and services in 7,000 Radio Shack outlets. Technology journalist Larry Magid joins us now. Larry, Gates seems a long way from being beaten.
Oh, that's right. Gates is I wouldn't say he's stronger than ever, but he's a very tenacious guy, and he does not take any bad news lying down or doesn't let it get to him. I mean, they're moving right ahead.
What's behind this Radio Shack deal?
Well, it's a great idea from Microsoft's standpoint. You know, Microsoft, even though it's a very large company, is in some sense a virtual company in that it doesn't have the kind of products that people traditionally think about in terms of physical locations. Sure, you can buy Microsoft software, you know, at CompUSA and other stores, but so much of its strategy now is around the Internet, which doesn't have a presence. And with Radio Shack, Microsoft now has 7,000 outlets to promote its Internet products as well as its off-the-shelf software. So it gives it a presence in our neighborhoods. I mean, Radio Shacks are everywhere, and Microsoft wants to be everywhere.
CBS MarketWatch correspondent Stacy Tisdale, it seems Bill Gates isn't just popular with shareholders.
He's certainly popular with Wall Street. A lot of people were surprised that the market did not give more of a pounding to Microsoft stock. But Wall Street didn't beat the stock up for several reasons. First, a Gallup poll this week showed that 68% of the public still have a favorable opinion of Gates. That suggests that we're going to continue to buy Microsoft products. In addition, this whole antitrust case has been factoring into the performance of this stock for quite some time. It hasn't surged the way you might have expected it. So it's kind of already been priced in. And no matter what, Microsoft has got one of the best management teams in the world, arguably in history. Wall Street always pays very close attention to that. But I think, Bill, the most important thing is the perception that the government has won a very big battle, but that the war is far from over. Some of the antitrust lawyers I spoke to last week said they even expect this to go to the Supreme Court.
Larry Gates told his shareholders he too would like to settle.
Well, that's what he's saying, and I'm sure he would like to settle, but the question is on whose terms will he settle? And, you know, it's not clear how much ground he's willing to give. So far, he hasn't given an awful lot of ground at all.
Well, the government won't be able to break up all of Microsoft, at least the old one, Stacy, because they spun off a big part of their business this week.
Yes, they spun off Expedia, which is Microsoft's internet travel site. And some on Wall Street were saying that this was, in a way, a concession to the government. The company's already starting to do what the government wants it to see. But I really don't think it's the case. First of all, the spinoff has been in the works for quite some time. And spinning off your internet divisions is very in vogue among corporations right now because companies are taking advantage of the popularity of internet stocks. Disney, for example, spun off GoTo.com. If you can spin off those successful internet subsidiaries, you can cash in on that internet stock craze without lumping those with your other assets that might not be doing so well. So I don't think it had very much to do with the antitrust case at all.
Of course, overall, technology stocks enjoyed a resurgence this past week.
Oh, yeah.
And for one particular company, the guys and gals in the brown uniforms have a lot more green now.
A lot of those guys and girls in brown uniforms are smiling brightly
this week.
United
Parcel Service.
We're talking about the UPS IPO. It was an amazing showing. Analysts that I've been speaking to are saying it's a keeper. It'd be a great addition to anyone's portfolio for the long term. But UPS is a great way to play the internet because all of those goods and services that we're purchasing online, this year is expected to be a record holiday shopping season online, they have to be delivered. And UPS has been one of the best beneficiaries of that. But Bill, when it comes to buying this stock, as you mentioned, it had a stellar trading debut. It's getting all of this push ahead of the holiday shopping season. Many Wall Street market watchers are saying that you might want to wait until after the holiday shopping season, but then it's definitely a keeper for the long term.
Well, the Fed Open Market Committee has another meeting coming up. What's going to happen with interest rates, Stacey?
Never a dull moment with those guys, but this is probably the most divided I think I've seen Wall Street about a Fed meeting in quite some time. 50-50 split among most of the analysts I've spoken to as to whether or not the Fed will raise rates. I think we're leaning slightly in favor of a rate hike. You still have that preemptive argument that Mr. Greenspan's been making that he wants to raise rates in order to slow the economy before inflation becomes a problem. All of the numbers we're seeing show that the labor market is still very tight. As long as workers are in such high demand, there's always the risk that wages are going to have to rise. That's what Mr. Greenspan wants to prevent. Also, Bill, the Fed seems on a mission to take back all of the interest rate cuts they made last year in an effort to boost the global economy. If that's what they're really thinking, then there's one more to go.
Well, Stacey, a consumer mini rebellion is in the making in parts of California against those fees charged by banks to non-customers for using their ATM machines. Correspondent David Dow, the banks have found a way to thwart the will of voters, at least in Santa Monica.
Well, that's right, Bill, at least temporarily. Two banks, the two biggest doing business in California, Bank of America and Wells Fargo, have, in effect, shut down their ATM machines in Santa Monica to non-customers of their banks. This will all get resolved in some form or another Monday when a federal court hearing is scheduled in San Francisco. But this, of course, is one of those issues that has smoldered in one form or another for some time across the country, not just in California. And another round here in California is coming up, potentially anyway. San Francisco voters earlier this month voted to do, in a sense, essentially what the Santa Monica City Council did, which was to outlaw those fees that are charged to non-regular customers of banks. And the Bank of America has already indicated that if it doesn't get any relief, it'll do the same thing in San Francisco that it's doing in Santa Monica.
Now, the legal argument that the banks make, David, is that the voters in San Francisco and the council in Santa Monica just doesn't have any authority over them.
Well, there is that, and the sort of common sense argument they make, or their appeal to common sense, is that they're offering a service to non-customers of their bank, and they ought to be paid for that service. Why should it be free? And they point out that there are, at least here in Southern California, that non-customers of their bank, if they don't want to, if they're not able to use the machines in Santa Monica, of course, have a vast metropolitan area with hundreds and hundreds, in fact, well over 1,000 other ATM machines in the case of Wells Fargo, more than that in the case of the Bank of America.
And Stacy, of course, the banks have literally billions of dollars riding on these fees, do they not?
Absolutely. And we're seeing so banks are so much in the headlines right now because of the repeal of the financial laws. It's the debate that's taking on right now in Washington. And that's one of the things that many members of Congress were worried about. The consumers are being subjected to all of these fees. Banks have made them such a big part of their profit statements. A lot of analysts say banks are using this kind of as free money. And once we saw all those fees and rules imposed, then it just became like a free source of revenues to banks. But this, I mean, this is just a fascinating case to me because it's interesting to see how a judge is going to weigh out on this. Just and a fascinating thing.
We'll see this coming week, perhaps. Thanks, David, Stacy, and Larry. Next up, the Texas dragging death case goes into its third trial. In Jasper, Texas this past week, Sean Allen Berry went on trial, the third and final white defendant in the brutal dragging death 17 months ago of James Byrd Jr., a black man. Correspondent Bob McNamara has been covering this case almost from the outset. Bob, Berry claims he was just an innocent bystander in all this.
Yes, he does. He said basically that he was just along for the ride, that he was a nice guy caught up with some evil people, and that he witnessed it, but he did not participate in the murder, the actual dragging death of James Byrd Jr.
Now, I gather there's some forensic evidence to contradict that.
Well, now there is blood evidence. There was blood on his shoes, on his pants, on his also on his shirt. It was his truck that was being used, but he claims that John William King, who was the first defendant convicted and sentenced to die in the case, who was actually the driver. The prosecution is trying to prove that it was Sean Berry who was actually driving the truck.
And as in the O.J. Simpson case, it comes down to a question of footwear.
Yeah, Sean Berry was wearing what were called polo boots, and John William King was wearing sandals. Through those shoe prints, the prosecution is trying to prove that it was Sean Berry who was driving, because apparently King got some blood on his shoes, and that there were blood marks on the passenger side. It's all very confusing and very complicated.
How long do we expect this trial to take, Bob?
Probably about a week and a half, barring any unforeseen delays. And we're also expecting Sean Berry to take the stand in his own defense.
And what is his claim, that he was participating out of fear?
He says that when Bill King and Russell Brewer got out to chain the man who died, he basically sat in the truck and did not participate. At first he told police that he ran away, but he changed that story to say that he was there, he listened, and that he did not actually participate in chaining him up and driving the vehicle. That he sat in the middle of the truck as the other two did all the work.
Now, there were a couple of side legal issues before testimony got underway in this case. One of them, an effort by the defense to move the case out of Jasper altogether.
Mm-hmm.
How did that resolve itself?
Well, CBS News had been sought to turn over transcripts and the video outtakes of correspondent Dan Rather's interview on 60 Minutes 2 with Sean Barry. CBS had objected to turning these things over on the grounds that the transcripts and outtakes, the video outtakes, are the broadcast equivalent of a print reporter's private notes and that they're protected by the First Amendment. And while 30 states and Washington, D.C. have laws that shield reporters' notes and sources from being seized by legal authorities, Texas does not. And the producer of this segment, Mary Mapes, had admitted on the stand that she did have a transcript of the interview and that it was at her home in Dallas. And so prosecutors went after that transcript because it was in Texas, and they went through the courts and finally decided to turn over the transcripts.
And CBS News was faced with a dilemma of sorts here. If it stuck to its guns on principle, mm-hmm. Mary Mapes would have gone to jail.
Yes, she would have. They won, CBS and Mary Mapes' attorneys won at least two stays against the judge's order to put her in jail. One was through a civil court, and one was through the Texas Criminal Courts of Appeals, which was the highest court in the state, and they lost both of those. The judge, interestingly, the judge had taken a very hard line on this, finally, to try and get this transcript, saying that if she didn't turn over the transcripts, he'd throw her in jail for perhaps as long as 6 months, and that he knew that that would cause a big stink in the media, and he would be forced to probably move the trial elsewhere, and that if he did, he would charge Mary Mapes personally with all the costs involved in this change of venue. And since they had exhausted every court in Texas, CBS finally struck a deal with the prosecutors to publish the transcript on the Internet, give the prosecutors a hard copy in exchange for dropping all charges against Mary Mapes, ending their subpoena to pursue Dan Rather as a trial witness. And now that they've seen the transcript, they don't feel that they need the videotapes, which are in New York, and they were pursuing that through the courts in New York, and that's going to be dropped also.
So if it were not for the Internet, CBS would not have been able to publish the entire interview,
mm-hmm.
And it gave them, CBS, as a news organization, at least a face-saving out on principle here.
Yes, everybody was looking for an out here. The judge and the prosecutor said they didn't want to send this woman to jail, especially after she was asked on the stand, "Do you have any children?" And she said, "Well, I have a two-year-old boy." Well, things like that in East Texas kind of strike home with these the men out there, and they did not want to have that. They didn't want to have that out there. They didn't want to put this woman in jail. So they were all looking for a way to kind of save face here. And you know, CBS really didn't have any choice really in the matter unless they wanted to go to federal court. And federal courts would probably uphold the law in Texas. So they were all looking for an out, and they got one.
And in this particular case, was there anything in those outtakes that either hurt or helped Sean Barry?
You know, there wasn't. There wasn't. There really wasn't. There were things in there that he liked Jasper a lot. He wanted to stay there. He had wanted to get married and raise a family and live there. That he'd been a bull rider when he was younger. There really wasn't. You know, in fact, what they actually came up with was what was on the air. It was that Bill King was wearing sandals. And from that, you know, they have gone after the footprint theory. And thus think that or trying to prove that Sean Barry was the driver of the truck.
So the principle for all this, from the CBS News point of view, is that news organizations should not become the handmaidens of the police and prosecutors.
Exactly, they shouldn't be another arm of the prosecutor's office to do their work.
Thank you, Bob McNamara, and good luck covering the trial. Also, our thanks this week to Bob Orr, Lou Meliano, Owen Bennett Jones, Tula Vlahu, Stacy Tisdale, Bob Fuss, David Dow, Larry Magid, General Perry Smith, Mark Noller, and Kimberly Dozier. Thanks for listening, and please join us again next week for another roundup of the week's news. I'm Bill Lynch, CBS News.
This has been the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Producers for the broadcast are Charles Kay and Michael Donahue. The associate producer is Michelle Cohen. The executive producer is Michael Friedman. This is the CBS Radio Network.